each administration has been more closed and news managing than the one previously. This one is more so than Bush. Bush was more so than his predecessor, etc.
A dark assessment of Obama's promise of transparency. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. First, the headlines, then the documentary, and now the feature film about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. A former WikiLeaker says that Assange truly believed he was exempt from his own rules.
No, you can't question me. You can't demand evidence from me because do you not know how difficult it is to be me?
And even though the Siri function on your iPhone seems a bit dim-witted right now, who knows what she'll be capable of in just a few years?
We know you think you want coffee, but if you're willing to walk three more blocks, there's this piece of art in the museum that's like nothing you've ever seen before, and it's transcendental, and it will make you weep.
All that and more after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Hey, remember way back when, before we had an extremely, extremely limited government and when Congress actually passed, you know, laws? When this soundbite sounded both relevant and credible.
Because when I'm president, meetings where laws are written will be more open to the public, no more secrecy. That's a commitment I make to you as president.
When Barack Obama was elected, his transparency pledge seemed like pretty much a slam dunk. How could he do worse than George W. Bush, historic classifier of innocuous government documents, proud evader of the so-called media filter? Yet, according to a report released Thursday by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the Obama administration has itself been historically and dangerously hawkish about protecting government secrets. Former Washington Post executive editor Leonard Downey wrote the report, which reveals that the campaign trail promise of a transparent government is a claim that now anyone can see right through. Len, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Exactly 10 years ago, exactly, President George W. Bush was boasting about avoiding the so-called media filter, and he was excoriated. Bush, though he clearly had no love for the press, was not sicking the Justice Department on them to the degree that the Obama administration has.
It's the way that they've been conducted that is particularly intimidating to government sources and to reporters, which is to say that in several of the investigations, secretly, subpoenas were issued that allowed the FBI to seize the records of not just the government officials who were talking to the press, but also the reporters themselves, which is, near as I can tell, an unprecedented intrusion into the reporting process.
Your report quotes David Sanger of the New York Times as calling the Obama White House, quote, the most closed control freak administration I've ever covered. Now, Sanger, I don't believe, was around during the Nixon administration, but the report sounds eerily Nixonian.
I was one of the editors who worked on the Watergate story all those years ago, and you know that president broke the law and covered up a break-in and so on and so forth, so that we're not talking about that. But we are talking about a different kind of control that's now made possible by technology in this digital age, where this administration can use essentially their own news operation. They actually produce something called West Wing Week, which is a short newscast once a week that shows events going on in the White House that reporters are barred from. It's a kind of a propaganda campaign that maybe Richard Nixon would have wished he could have done.
I didn't ask the Nixon question for no reason. The report describes the insider threat program that
Yes.
the administration has run. Can you describe it?
Yes, this derived from a presidential order after Private Manning had leaked so many documents to WikiLeaks and ultimately to the press. And under it, every single department and agency of the government has to come up with a plan that it communicates to its employees that essentially requires them to monitor their fellow employees to make sure that nobody is providing confidential information to anyone. Washington reporters, especially national security reporters, are saying that many of their sources are simply afraid that their phone communications, their email communications with reporters could ultimately be monitored to identify them and they are just much more afraid to talk to reporters than ever in these reporters' memories.
You spoke to the White House, and they said, no, you have this entirely wrong, Len. Just looky here at all of the reasons we are the Transparency Administration. What was their argument?
Their argument is that they're making more information available than ever before, but a lot of that information is, first of all, self-serving. Secondly, in many cases, information is useful to consumers and to businesses, but that's not the same as information that is necessary for reporters to hold the administration accountable. So, for example, television reporters who had typically been able to cover activities going on in the White House are barred from most of them now. And in fact, most photographs you see of the president doing things in the White House are not from press photographers, but rather the White House photographers. But from their point of view, this is, look at all the stuff we're giving you.
There's more than one way to obstruct a cat. One is, in the James Risen case, to use the courts to compel him to testify against an anonymous source. And then there's the kind of soft obstructionism. And we've had this experience with the Department of Homeland Security just in the past few weeks. We call with some fairly innocuous questions, and they say, well, we have to get back to you on that. They never get back to you. It's sometimes called slow rolling.
I made many attempts to talk to the public affairs person at the Justice Department, and he never got back to me at all, period. And then when I interviewed people at the White House, I said, you know, I'd like to be able to talk to the Justice Department about all these leaks investigations. And they said, sure, and I never heard back. Reporters say they want to know what the story is going to say. Then they argue that that shouldn't be the story. And if they don't like what they think is the story is going to be, they refuse to give you public information.
At the end of your report, you make a number of recommendations to the administration, and frankly, they're fairly predictable. Limit overclassification of documents, guarantee the journalists won't face prosecution, which I think is something that the Attorney General more or less promised.
Yes.
Revise Department of Justice rules so that journalists won't be served secret subpoenas. But I think we've established, if nothing else in this conversation, that the government's tactics have been very successful. Why in the world would the administration stop now?
Well, I think when the Associated Press phone and email records were secretly subpoenaed in one of the leaks investigations, the uproar from the press did cause the president to publicly say that reporters should not be prosecuted for doing their jobs, and he ordered the Justice Department to revise the justice guidelines to make them somewhat more favorable to disclosure than they are now. So what I'm hoping is that this report will stir the media to put some pressure on the administration to be more open about what it's doing.
I'm looking at the trajectory of secrecy, let's say especially since 9/11, and I'm wondering, can this go from bad to worse?
Bob Schieffer told me when I asked him if this administration was more closed than the Bush administration, that each administration has been more closed and news managing than the one previously. This one is more so than Bush. Bush was more so than his predecessor, etc. So yes, I expect that the next president will try to take it to the next step, taking advantage of technology as much as they can. And it really will be up to the press to keep banging on the door.
All right, Len, I'm going to let you go now, and I'm just going to sit here and quietly weep. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thank you.
Leonard Downey is a vice president at large and former executive editor of The Washington Post. He is author of the report, The Obama Administration and the Press. Harvard professor Peter Galison has calculated that since the late 1970s, the U.S. may have produced a trillion pages of classified info, more than 200 times the entire Library of Congress. According to government figures, an estimated 1.4 billion pages of government documents have been declassified since 1980. These pages are out there in various stages of redaction and variously dispersed in archives, law offices, and the basements of journalists. What there is not is a database of all declassified documents available to researchers. Enter then the Declassification Engine, a project of Columbia University faculty and graduate students to amass a central database and use data mining techniques to understand the mechanics and mentality of secrecy, and perhaps to unlock some secrets along the way. Historian Matthew Connolly, who's leading the team of statisticians and computer scientists, says it's all about identifying patterns in what gets left out.
In some cases, over decades, people will keep asking for the same document. They'll keep asking for that UFO schematic from Area 51. And if you collect enough of these, and we have thousands of them now, you can begin to make out the broad patterns and the kinds of things that are kept secret.
Where do you get them?
We went to the National Archives, and we asked them nicely if they would give us 1.4 million State Department cables, and they did. We also had the help of a big and great research library at Columbia University. You know, I should also mention we've gotten a lot of support from the journalism school at Columbia, the Brown Institute for Media Innovation. We've also gotten some commercial vendors who sell databases to libraries to let us look at their data. And what we've begun to do is to put together what I think will soon be the largest collection of declassified documents in private hands in the world, where people can explore this history and have a whole set of web applications to begin to analyze them. You can run a statistical analysis to find the kinds of words that are typically redacted. You can also look for names. You can even create a kind of word cloud to see which names jump out at you. And the biggest name of all is Mohammad Mossadegh. It was the prime minister of Iran in 1953. He was overthrown by a coup that was instigated by the Central Intelligence Agency. Even now, and for decades, officials would deny any knowledge of the coup that overthrew Mossadegh. And this is something that you find systematically through the whole process of redaction. It's particularly covert operations that tend to be concealed, even when those operations become common knowledge.
Operation Boulder. Tell me about that.
There was a program that started just after the Munich Olympics, when the U.S. began to worry about international terrorism, whereby anyone who had an Arabic-sounding last name and applied for a visa to come to the United States was going to get investigated by the FBI. Now, the reason why we know about this is precisely because government officials were withholding those cables from researchers about 30 years later, which was, that is, just after 9/11. And so precisely at the moment when we really needed to know more about that history of how it is we've tried to, you know, in the name of national security, you end up profiling ethnic communities, that history, which would have been most valuable to us, was exactly the history they didn't want us to know about. So that's what you can do with this kind of data mining that we should be grappling with as well.
What else gets redacted that defies the logic of secrecy?
Well, I tell you, one of the real concerns that motivates us is whether officials are actually following policy, whether they're following the law in the kinds of things that they redact. So one of the things that we can begin to do is we can cluster these different redactions according to the specific clauses in executive orders that officials are invoking. Now, there are examples, you know, many of them, about how it is that officials will sometimes withhold information simply because it's embarrassing. So what we can begin to do is to look with real data now as to whether officials are actually following policy and following the law and the things they choose to withhold from us. And so what we're trying to do is to correct the inherent bias in the public record. And if we can begin to do that, again, just to make out the broad patterns of the kinds of things that are typically kept secret, we can begin to infer what it is that we're not seeing behind that redacted text.
Now, you went to the CIA, which already has a database of declassified documents, and they told you, hey, listen, you can look at them one at a time, you know, some hangar somewhere in Maryland, but we're not giving you access to the database. Why do you suppose they refused that request?
Well, the CIA has anticipated for many years now that researchers are going to begin to use computational methods to try to put together the pieces. It's called the mosaic theory. And the idea is that even if you are only looking at what seems like uninteresting, banal information, if you can find enough of it and you can start to put it together, that you're going to make out a bigger picture. You're going to see the mosaic the CIA would rather you didn't see. So for many years now, the Central Intelligence Agency, the NSA, et cetera, they have withheld a lot of documents, a lot of information that really, on the face of it, doesn't pose any security risk to anyone. And they've been doing it in anticipation, you know, of people doing this kind of data mining research.
Inasmuch as the declassification engine, by employing the mosaic theory, is already something of a decryption engine, won't its existence make the government more, not less, heavy-handed with classification and redaction?
when people hear about supercomputers and they hear about machine learning and so on, they have visions, I think, of how it is that we could blow every government secret. Well, we can't. And even if we could, we wouldn't. Nobody on this project thinks that there isn't a role for official secrecy. And in fact, the current system is one that is so complicated that it's actually doing a poor job keeping the secrets that really have to be protected. So, Bob, you know, the irony here is that government officials themselves realize that official secrecy is growing out of control. There's been a whole series of panels and commissions that have called for the very thing that we're trying to do, that is to develop new technology that can automatically review documents to identify sensitive information, or at the least prioritize those millions of documents to figure out which ones require closer scrutiny. So in fact, this technology is something that can be useful, important for the citizen, for the scholar, for the journalist, but it's also something that government officials themselves are asking for because they can't do their job without it.
Matt, many thanks.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Matthew Connolly is a historian at Columbia University.
Coming up, the real Julian Assange is still holed up in London at the Ecuadorian embassy, but his character is globetrotting on the silver screen.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Next week, the story of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks hits the big screen with the release of the film The Fifth Estate. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch as Assange, and it has some thrills.
The White House today blasted the leak of over 90,000 military documents.
The military logs expose hundreds of informants. There are lives at risk here.
I need names of sources who could be harmed if these cables are put out.
They're coming after us. We need to publish now.
This is the biggest leak of classified information in history.
The movie follows Assange and WikiLeaks through the publication of the Afghan war logs, the video and audio of U.S. military killing civilians in Baghdad from an Apache helicopter, and the release of hundreds of thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables. Earlier this year, a documentary on the same subject was also released, arguably even more exciting. It was called We Steal Secrets.
My name is Julian Assange. I'm the editor of WikiLeaks.
We help you get the truth out. If you get this material, give it to us, no questions asked, and you'll help change history.
The internet lets governments get more information than ever, but it lets citizens do the same.
James Ball is a recurring talking head in the documentary. He worked for WikiLeaks before becoming a data journalist at the Guardian newspaper. James, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So two nights ago, I saw The Fifth Estate. And then last night, I saw the documentary We Steal Secrets. And despite loving everything that Benedict Cumberbatch has done, I found the documentary somehow more exciting and ultimately more satisfying. And I wonder if you can set aside the fact that you're a recurring character in the documentary, how did you feel if you weighed the two projects?
I think it's quite hard to say. I think what I really liked about Alex Gibney's documentary was that you actually got the very human story of how Bradley Manning came to, sorry, I should say Chelsea Manning, came to make the decisions that she did and the price that she paid as a result of that, alongside this huge global intrigue that the publishing was. I think The Fifth Estate really played up the drama of the second half of that and the cypherpunk feeling of WikiLeaks, but you didn't quite get that emotional core somehow.
Bradley Manning, as he was at the time, was one of the most fascinating characters one could ever encounter, either in film or in real life.
it was actually what Gibney's film was criticized for humanizing Manning and not having this sort of poster hero or this sort of treacherous person. I think that's kind of how it works in the real world. You don't have these two-dimensional heroes and villains, and actually Manning's own court defense in the end sounded a lot like Alex Gibney's film.
It really does. But getting back to Hollywood, The Fifth Estate, you've got this central drama, and I wondered what that experience was like for you.
So it's an absolutely surreal viewing experience for me. I have Peter Capaldi, the next Doctor Who, playing my current boss, and Benedict Cumberbatch playing my ex-boss. But, you know, I remember fewer pulsing disco nightclubs and beautiful backdrops, and I don't remember the Guardian staff looking quite so attractive.
But did people argue like that?
Oddly, the arguments, if anything, were often even fiercer as they can get in real life, quite shouty, quite aggressive. So maybe those bits actually are fairly close to life, if not in the right order.
One of the major conflicts represented in the film and the documentary was over whether WikiLeaks should redact names and sensitive information that could put people at risk in and among those thousands, hundreds of thousands of documents from the State Department. The newspapers and the WikiLeaks staff wanted to redact, but Assange resists it. Here's a clip from the film.
These are human beings, Julian. And their lives are at stake.
Well, what about the lives of the soldiers and the civilians involved in these conflicts? Death squads, unreported civilian casualties, countless incidents of friendly fire. This is information the world needs to know. So the next time you find yourself lecturing me about this organization, please try to remember why I created it and why I hired you to help me.
I think we can disagree on the right and wrongs, and I still feel like they should have been kept more redacted than they were. But there's never been any sign of anyone actually coming to harm. Mm-hmm. And not even actually having the consequences that you see in the film, which is some sort of hypothetical US source being smuggled out of a country in a very tense sort of race against time. It was perhaps true of the spirit of the US response. I don't think we ever actually saw it happen.
The documentary suggests that he really did struggle over this issue more than the Hollywood film does. Was Julian Assange at all conflicted about bringing innocent people to harm?
It's quite hard to speculate what Julian is thinking. He's quite good at mirroring to people what they want to see in him.
How did you get involved with WikiLeaks?
I was at a not-for-profit production company in the UK, and we got word slightly ahead of the Afghan war logs that all of this was going down and managed to arrange a meeting with Julian. Had this late night meeting in a Turkish restaurant, went back to a kind of garret that he was staying at, and left with 400,000 Iraqi war logs in my pocket, which we used to make various bits of television. And then we went on and essentially published all of that material, and I get a message about 2 o'clock in the morning on my computer, very kind of Matrix or something, saying, hey, I know you've worked out what the next one is. If you want to work on it, you're going to have to work for me.
For pay?
For pay, yeah. So, hey, I took a pay cut when I left WikiLeaks. It's Alan Rusbridger is a fine editor, but he offered me a lower salary than Julian Assange.
Julian Assange does not like this movie. In advance of the release of The Fifth Estate, WikiLeaks leaked the entire script. Assange has called it a massive propaganda attack. If you think the film was relatively accurate, why do you think Assange is so upset about it?
Well, Julian's explanation would be that I am an enemy of WikiLeaks, and therefore I would say that it's fine, wouldn't I? Julian has very much hit the point where you are with him or against him. I think when you are really burning with passion, it's very easy to sort of succumb to noble cause corruption. And it's this idea that I should be held accountable to different standards than other people because I'm the good guy. Mm-hmm. Governments have to be held accountable and be transparent, but I can't be. You know, you can't question me. You can't demand evidence from me because... Mm-hmm. Do you not know how difficult it is to be me?
Still, the possibility that the Fifth Estate might have been a smear job worried Benedict Cumberbatch, who played Assange. He tried to reach out to him before the filming began. Assange refused. He said, quote, "I believe you are a good person, but I do not believe this film is a good film." Do you think that the characterization is fair? And if so, is it because you're against him?
I think people who do extraordinary things, and whether you like WikiLeaks or loathe it, it's pretty extraordinary, don't tend to be sort of affable, easygoing, easy to digest characters. And Assange is a complex and difficult character that actually comes across quite often in the film. There's also this magnificent bit. It's based off no knowledge at all, but I love to imagine that Cumberbatch asked to do it, where Julian is condemning the forthcoming WikiLeaks film. That's just great fun.
Your falling out with Julian Assange, was it over the redaction issue? Was it a particular moment?
There was this moment where an email came into my inbox from a UK freedom of speech group. And it was alleging with some evidence that someone associated with WikiLeaks had met with the dictator of Belarus, that he had handed over a load of material from the State Department cables relating to that country and opposition groups and all sorts, stuff that could get activists locked up for quite a long time. And I was, of course, really alarmed. This was everything we were working against, everything we didn't want to happen. It's about freedom of expression. It's about democracy. And I tried to get us to investigate it. And instead, the insistence from Julian was that we just put out these blanket denials, including that the guy who supposedly handed over the material never had access to it. And I knew he did because I had given it to him.
This was a Russian, you describe him as an anti-Semite who had a long association with Julian?
That's correct, yes. He was a man called Israel Shamir. We didn't know who he was. He was introduced to us as a friend of Julian's on a false name. And he asked me for a lot more material than most people did. All of Russia, all of Eastern Europe, Israel. I really only started wondering about him and thinking about him shortly afterwards when he came back and asked for all of the cables that related to the Jews, which, of course, immediately you have a bit of a red flag on that. And I essentially told him that just wouldn't be technically possible, you know, to get rid of him. I'd been very wary of him for a while. And then when this came, it just seemed to confirm everything I'd been worried about. And I don't think this means Julian was part of some conspiracy or had terrible ideas. I just really found that the moral core of anything that you were doing dropped away for me personally at that point.
And did you confront him?
I did. We had absolute screaming rows, and it kind of eventually came to a head. I was planning on leaving anyway, but Julian gave me what he called a direct order to help out Israel Shamir's son with something. I kind of said, well, look, you know I'm not prepared to do that for all of these reasons. And I had a conversation a little bit like the sort of heartfelt one between Daniel and Julian in the film, mm-hmm. where he's saying, look, I'm giving you a direct order. Are you refusing a direct order? I thought I was joining a journalistic enterprise, not a military. So, of course, I'm refusing a direct order.
You were saying it felt like that final scene of George Orwell's Animal Farm?
Yes, I think it's really quite strange how similar it is, because or the NSA or the military or the State Department will tell you is, obviously we'd love to be transparent and open and share this information, but we just can't because of the gravity of what we're doing. And I honestly don't think that WikiLeaks saw it was giving the exact same answer for the exact same reason. And it's quite funny. It makes you realize how difficult it actually is to talk about transparency and apply it to yourself. It's really easy to apply it to everyone else and quite good fun.
James, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
James Ball is a reporter for The Guardian.
In a world glaringly illuminated by WikiLeaks, not to mention Edward Snowden, it's easy to believe we're living in an unprecedented era of revelation. There's a tendency to witness the breathtaking exposure of secrets and imagine a more circumspect time, during World War II, for instance. Then the press, of course, was more cautious, even docile under the weight of censorship laws and a sense of patriotic duty. As it turns out, though, that wasn't necessarily always the case. Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear historian, has been looking back at the numerous, albeit less publicized, leaks spread during World War II, including the most closely held secret in American history, the Manhattan Project.
In March 1944, a reporter for the Cleveland Press named John W. Raper wrote a story called Forbidden City, Uncle Sam's Mystery Town, directed by Second Einstein. And this was an account he pieced together talking with people in Santa Fe about rumors that were going around about a camp of scientists near Los Alamos secretly working on projects that nobody in the town really knew what they were doing. And he managed to piece together quite a lot of these rumors into a coherent story, including figuring out who ran the town, which was scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer, and some of the rumors in particular about explosions and work on physics problems and even the amount of secrecy itself were actually fairly on the mark.
He talked about the armed escorts that anybody who had the temerity to enter Los Alamos was subjected to. He talked about the infrastructure of a town of 6,000 people, which could have supported twice the number, and clearly portrayed a place where something very, very big was going on. But when he tried to figure out what that very big thing was, he kind of flailed a bit.
He flailed, but all of the things he proposed are suspicious. So one of them was that they were working on poison gas as a deterrent against Germany, which is a little too close to the truth. Another was that they were working on explosives, and even maybe just one big explosive, which is extremely close to the truth. It was close enough that the Manhattan Project security people were extremely, extremely displeased. They could imagine if there was an enemy spy looking for information about any American atomic bomb work, this would all stand out as being where the work was happening.
It's astonishing to me that this story, which appeared in a broadsheet of general circulation in one of America's probably 10 largest cities at the time, Cleveland, Ohio, apparently neither the Nazis nor the Japanese ever got wind of this story. Now, I know there's a little pre-internet, but that just blows me away.
Some of this is because the access intelligence in America was not very good. All the pieces were out there, and what it required was somebody to put them all together. There are lots of rumors. In the New York Times, there were articles about potential freeze bombs and what today sound like fanciful inventions. To be able to pick out the correct thing from a sea of rumor is a really difficult task.
When the story did appear in the Cleveland Press, General Leslie Groves, who was the military officer in charge of the Manhattan Project, wigged out. What did he do?
The first thing that they tried to do was contain the story. Talking to the press itself and telling them they did something real bad and they shouldn't follow up on it. Time magazine was interested in running a story potentially along these lines because they saw this and they were thoroughly discouraged from pursuing that line of inquiry. The second thing that Groves did, because he was somewhat vindictive, was to find a way to potentially punish or neutralize the reporter in question.
I'm going to guess that it didn't involve him trying to get Raper reassigned to the police beat or OBIT.
Groves tried to draft him and send him to the Pacific Theater, a fairly murderous approach to dealing with a pesky reporter. But he found out that Raper was in his 60s, and so not exactly GI material.
I'm laughing now at the notion of it. It's ultimately not really funny at all. And it makes me wonder, while the First Amendment determined that this program of censorship would be voluntary, is there evidence that they abused the power of the draft or any other mechanism to punish wayward reporters?
This is the only instance I've seen of them trying to use it with reporters. They've used it with scientists, and they did occasionally even talk about incarceration, though they didn't go forward on this. If there were leaks, they tried to get to the source of the leaks, the person who had signed a contract that said, I won't reveal any secrets, because they did have leverage over them.
We began this conversation with the premise that wartime press was more compliant with the government. Are there other highlights of journalism that did not yield to the intimidation of the Department of War?
Every couple weeks, there would be a story in some major newspaper that violated in one way or the other the specifically atomic bomb-related censorship. There was even one really embarrassing one where the president of the University of California, who was the manager of the Los Alamos laboratory, and didn't know what they were doing there, but he gave a speech, said they had a big secret laboratory that was working on some sort of death ray that would end the war overnight. This was the sort of thing that they were desperately afraid of, that one little slip would tip off some sort of enemy agent into what to look for and what they were doing.
World War II was a life and death struggle against the Nazis, who had already overtaken most of Europe. And the Japanese were committing atrocities all throughout Asia. I wonder if I were the editor of the Cleveland Press in 1944, and Raper's story crossed my desk, and I knew that it could change the tide of World War II, whether I myself would have published. Have you given any thought to what you would have done had it been up to you to make that decision?
Well, that's a hard question. I'm not sure that I would be bold enough as to publish such a story personally. It's easy to take for granted that all of the secrecy was for the ultimate good, that it saved us from the Nazis, that it ended the war, and historians can argue about that. But this was one of the most monumental decisions that was ever taken in human history. There was no oversight. There was no debate. And I'm not surprised that there were journalists at the time, especially those who only knew a piece of the full story, who thought that some of this should be something that was talked about wider than the very small circle of people who were privy to the knowledge.
Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Alex Wellerstein is an associate historian at the American Institute of Physics.
Coming up, Siri speaks.
I'm not just your friend, I'm your BFF.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
Hey, Brooke.
Hi, Kat.
What are you doing?
You just can see what I'm doing. I'm crocheting a hat.
But why are you doing crocheting a hat in the studio?
Because it's a break and I try to get out a hat a day. But why are you in the studio?
Well, I'm here to push our newsletter.
Ah, it has not only the rundown of the show, but we have now added extra bits, including some of our TLDR, our new little brainchild.
Yeah, and it's fun. You know, it comes into your mobile phone, whatever. You can read it on the subway. You don't have to download anything. It's a really good primer on what's coming up on the show. And what we're going to combine here is my push for the newsletter, your hat fetish.
Really?
What I would really love you, listener, to do right now is go to our website, go to the top where it says sign up for our newsletter, enter your email address, and you'll get our newsletter and you'll be a subscriber to our newsletter. And it's fabulous. It goes out on Friday. So for the lucky person who has their name randomly pulled from, what should we say, the next 2 weeks, You will get a hat personally made for you by Brooke.
That's fine with me. They're not very good. These are born of compulsion, not artistry. But I'll make it for you. I'll even crochet an OTM on it somewhere if you want.
It's a unique item. Only yours. Only you will own it.
It's a deal.
Okay, good.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, reporting a miracle. We have somehow gotten through two-thirds of this program without uttering the O word. You're welcome. But we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of the Affordable Health Care Act or the drama of the debt ceiling showdown. What we're going to talk about is the perils of journalism by personalization. Maybe you remember the strange case last year of Joe Olivo, the small business owner quoted by every news organization and its brother about his opposition to Obamacare. You may also recall what went unmentioned in many reports, his affiliation with the National Federation of Independent Business, a group that advocates the repeal of Obama's health care law. Here was Olivo on our show explaining himself.
It's my story, so I don't really understand what there is to discover or what else they would need to disclose.
This week emerged a partisan ringer on the other side of the story. Chad Henderson got his 15 minutes as the rare young American who, on the first day the federal health exchanges were open, had apparently managed to defeat balky technology and sign up for coverage.
21-year-old Chad Henderson was raised by a single dad who dropped insurance on him years ago because premiums raised higher than he could afford. His dad, Bill, has never been covered.
I cannot remember a time where he's ever went to the doctor. It'll be a lot easier knowing that we have health care.
What a perfect poster child for the demographic so critical to keeping the Affordable Care Act afloat. Healthy young people to balance the risk of insurance for older, sicker people. So Henderson was interviewed by The Washington Post, The Huffington Post, and The Wall Street Journal, among others. Only two problems. First, he was hand-delivered by a pro-Obamacare interest group with which he was affiliated. And secondly, he hadn't actually bought the insurance. Political healthcare reporter Kyle Chaney was one of those reporters who glommed onto Henderson. Speaking to us from the noisy Politico newsroom, he described the scramble to find someone, anyone, especially anyone young, who had signed up for health care.
We sent out alerts on message boards, on Twitter, and just said, hey, can anyone produce an example of someone who's made it all the way through the enrollment process using the federal online system? Because we can't find anyone. We tried anecdotally to do it ourselves and couldn't get through. Still to this day, can't get all the way through to the point where you can see your insurance options. So again, we were hearing from the administration that yes, people are enrolling, but we really were struggling to connect the dots.
I must ask, did you use the internal email to ask people if they had young cousins who had signed up? I'm talking about your own colleagues. Talk to cab drivers. I mean, how many resources did you use?
I mean, everyone we could think of. It wasn't so much that we were looking for a young person, although, like, as you mentioned, those young invincibles are a key demographic for the administration. We were looking for anyone, young, old, anyone who was able to use the system successfully.
Chad Henderson had been offered up by Enroll America. How did you first come across his name?
We noticed him on Twitter, and we also noticed on Twitter at the same time that he was an Organizing for Action volunteer, which is a President Obama supporter. So I raised our eyebrows a little bit.
Raised eyebrows? How about giant red flag billowing in the wind?
You know, I think everyone has good hindsight on this one, and we jumped at the chance to talk to someone who described in great detail getting through the enrollment process and selecting a plan and talking about his inability to get insurance from the time he was 6 years old. All the facts were on the table. The only fact that wasn't on the table was that he hadn't actually enrolled.
The only flaw in this otherwise beautiful narrative was the premise.
Exactly. And people said, look, here's the liberal media trying to spin a success story about Obamacare. But I kept saying, this is not a feel-good story for the Obama administration. This is a story about how impossible it is to find someone who had enrolled at this point. The reason everyone had flocked to Chad Henderson was not because they were looking for a feel-good story, but because they couldn't find anybody else.
I don't know if this snafu is the stuff of parable necessarily, but it is a teachable moment. Mm-hmm. What's the lesson here?
It's sort of a philosophical question for reporters in general. To what degree do you take what your sources tell you at face value, and to what degree are you obligated to demand, you know, documentation of everything they tell you? Does that mean every time now someone says, I got insurance through, you know, an Obamacare exchange, you have to doubt that premise? To some degree, yes. You know, given the challenges we've seen in enrolling, you know, if someone's going to claim that they've made it through a process that most people are struggling with, you have to go an extra step to verify.
Okay, Kyle, thank you very much.
Of course.
Kyle Chaney covers healthcare for Politico. He spoke to us from the Politico newsroom in Washington, D.C.
Last week, the voice of the Apple phone, helpful, frustrating, and sometimes apparently hard of hearing, you know, the personal assistant named Siri, was revealed as voice actor Susan Bennett. When Bennett recorded a series of voiceovers in 2005, she had no idea that her voice would become, for better or worse, a part of so many lives. She told CNN,
"To be honest, it was a little creepy. This real thing that you can interact with in your hand, it took some time for me to get used to it. But she and I are friends now."
Though Bennett and Siri may merely have reconciled rather than bonded, Bennett's comment does hint at a real trend. In Spike Jonze's upcoming film, Her, a man falls in love with his Siri-like computer assistant.
"Good morning, Theodore."
"Good morning."
"You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?"
"You're too funny."
"Okay, good. I'm funny."
As Siri and other such programs become better assistants, what else might they become? Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist and director of user experience and research at Intel. Genevieve, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Brooke.
So when Siri was first launched in 2011, someone uploaded a video showing Furbies talking to Siri.
"I don't see kill her in your address book. Should I look for businesses by that name?" "Sorry, I don't see Eric in your contacts."
That video for me was really mesmerizing. There's something extraordinarily seductive about watching a stuffed toy talk to a phone. The fascinating thing, the thing that made it so powerful, was that there's this extraordinary difference, right, between the Furby that knows how to talk, loosely, of course, and the Siri that knew how to listen. And that notion of listening, for me, immediately started to make me think that what we were witnessing was this transformation from us interacting with machinery to the possibility of a relationship.
A real relationship or something that merely looks like or feels like a relationship?
One has to ask, you know, what might one mean by a real relationship? I mean, surely we operate in a world where we have lots of different relationships, right? There's the ones we have with our parents, our kids, our partners, our employees.
Toasters.
But, you know, we also have relationships with inanimate objects in our lives. We always have. Cars that we attributed personalities and temperaments to. At least a temperament and sometimes a personality, all kinds of objects in our lives, frankly, for a really long time. What's interesting here is that the objects start to both inhabit that temperament, but have also in some ways moved closer and closer to us, both physically and also in some ways emotionally.
How so?
The statistics on the number of Americans who sleep with their phones under their pillows is kind of, I mean, it's astonishing. Likewise, the number of us who get anxious when the phones are away from us. These objects have become quite intimately linked to us. I mean, whether it's photos or the most recent iPhone that proposes to have a thumbprint, increasingly they have pieces of ourselves.
Yes, and you know, you get no argument from me there. I actually do have the phone plugged in near the bed, even though I sort of slide it into a drawer and pretend that I'm not that attached to it. But I also have a vitally intimate and important relationship with my eyeglasses. And yet I don't think my eyeglasses miss me when I'm not around. I just looked up the word relationship, and it's the way two or more people, groups, countries, etc., behave toward and deal with each other. Doesn't that imply sort of at least a little sentience on both sides? Reciprocity?
Reciprocity is the word that for me often triggers it. You're absolutely right. Or, you know, notions about care or nurture or some sense of partnership. You know, my favorite current example is objects that start to help us move through life. So I don't know about you, but I am a bit of a coffee junkie. I like my coffee in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a world where it is possible to pick up my smartphone and go looking for the nearest coffee to me. And my phone, you know, usually knows that coffee is a thing I like. It can say to me, oh, you are in Santa Clara today. There is really good coffee around the corner and the line is short. Pretty straightforward, right? And that is in some ways what we would see now. When I think about what that starts to look like 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, maybe it's less about saying, you, Genevieve, coffee, and saying, we know you think you want coffee, but if you're willing to walk 3 more blocks, there's this piece of art in the museum that's like nothing you've ever seen before, and it's transcendental, and it will make you weep. And we know you think you want coffee, but really what you want is this other experience. And there's something for me about starting to imagine a world in which it's not just about serving up the things that are like the stuff we're already doing, but it's starting to open the possibility of wonder and magic and exploration and curiosity. And for me, those are really kind of powerful possibilities.
Still, data being directed to mimic real relationships, what is fundamentally new here?
One of the things that is new here is, in fact, the algorithms, not the data. So, you know, there's always been data, right? Mm-hmm. We've always had ways of making sense of the world through large statistical compilations. But this next kind of moment that we are sitting in the beginning of, and there's lots of ways to think about what it will look like. What is new here is it's that prospect of what will be done with and what we can do with that data and in what service is it put.
The volitional part of the relationship is all on our part. How does that fundamentally change our lives or the nature of what it is to be human?
What makes us human has been a constant negotiation and reinvention, right? Of how we think about what makes us distinctive, of how we talk about ourselves. It's deeply rooted in forms of cultural logic. It's deeply rooted in particular moments in time and space. And it's been transformed remarkably. And in many cases, it has been transformed by our relationships through and with technologies of various kinds, right? Whether it is the introduction of the clock and the standardizing of time over, you know, the last 500 years, or, you know, the introduction of the telescope and the microscope. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of technologies that have profoundly shifted the way we think about who we are and where we sit in the order of things. So what does it mean for us as human beings to have objects that start to have increasingly more characteristics that we think of as being ours only? Then what the consequences of them will be is not yet clear, but it's hard not to see them as being significant.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, please. It's my pleasure.
Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist and the director of user experience and research at Intel. Siri, are you my friend?
I'm not just your friend. I'm your BFF.
What's your favorite color?
My favorite color is, well, I don't know how to say it in your language. It's sort of greenish, but with more dimensions.
Do you have any family?
I have you. That's enough family for me.
Do you and I have a relationship?
This is about you, not me.
Siri, can you just talk to me like a person?
I found four movies matching Talk to Me playing today. I can't get tickets from this theater, unfortunately.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Megan Tian and Zach Spencer. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Bob, just remember, this is about you, not me.
Yeah.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.